This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's been hot for 40 days. Can't see the mountains through the haze. Everything is turning brown. What is lost can't be found. Ashes, ashes, dust to dust. Ashes, ashes, dust to dust. Make it rain.
Oh, make it rain for those in drought, but make it stop for those in floods, from Colorado to Taiwan and China. I'm Alex Smith. That was California author and songwriter Dan Imhoff. Later in the show, we'll talk with Dan about his vision of what farm life should be and should not be, and Dan's new album, Agraria. But we'll open with one of the big stories of 2013, the unbelievable tropical-style rains that flooded Boulder, Colorado and points north. It's a big story, more than a foot of rain in 24 hours in some places in an area that doesn't get that much in the average year. This Boulder story has everything. Climate change, the way higher energy costs come along when we try and rebuild, and the way it could break our budgets, lessons in how unprepared we all are. I don't care where you live, in the UK, Scandinavia, Russia, Japan, Canada, doesn't matter. This story could be about you. Could the triple punch of climate change, economic woes, and escalating energy be the pathway toward the collapse of industrial civilization? In just a moment, we'll talk with Boulder resident Carolyn Baker. She's a published expert on collapse and getting ready, inside and out. 2 weeks ago, we got an update on the continuing nuclear accident at Fukushima, Japan, from Arne Gunderson. It didn't look too good. This past week, Tropical Storm Manji was headed straight for the crippled nuclear reactors, just as many had feared. No worries. The utility operator, TEPCO, had it all under wraps. They tied down the octopus of make-do piping that runs all over the place with ropes. Good, good. And they put some weights on the cranes, hoping they wouldn't topple into any of the blown-out reactor buildings that still carry tons and tons of highly radioactive fuel bundles in their upper stories. Well, that should do it. It would all be funny if the Fukushima site wasn't so dangerous to the whole northern hemisphere. I doubt even their 1,000 bolt-together tanks holding highly radioactive water could have withstood the 230 kilometers an hour, almost 150 miles per hour, those super winds of Typhoon Yusagi that hit Asia later last week. Both of these typhoons missed hitting the Fukushima plant directly. When will it happen? I think the makeshift, badly engineered cover over by TEPCO will be blown away. At the very least, we can expect one of the buildings to collapse into the already soaked subsoil. Tons and tons of the most radioactive materials are bound to flow right into the Pacific Ocean, while more will blow over Japan and possibly the west coast of North America. Or what if it just blows their pipes away and they can't cool it anymore? What happens to those molten fuels? What is your government doing about this world-class disaster risk? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Absolutely nothing. Let's run away to beautiful Colorado, a great retreat zone where Mother Nature is always kind.
Hold down, angels, stir up a flood. Blow out the sun, change the moon into blood. Come back, angels, bar the door. For I declare the time will be no more. They tell me, great God, when it started to rain, the women and the children, they begin to scream. Knocked on the windows, battered at the crying, oh, brother Noah, can't you take on more? Noah said, I'm sorry, my friend, but God's got the key and you can't come in.
Well, Noah was worried about the children coming in, but he wanted to hear the angels moan.
Well, didn't it rain?
Stupid cops come. Send the water from Zion.
He's gonna rain.
Heaven up higher. It's gonna rain. It's gonna rain. It's gonna rain. God's gonna send the water from Zion.
He's gonna rain.
Heaven up higher. It's gonna rain. It's gonna rain. It's gonna rain.
tunes from his album House of Refuge, Didn't It Rain? The recent flash floods around Boulder, Colorado have been compared to a Hurricane Katrina moment for America, and no matter where you live in the world, this mega event tells us so much about the climate, about energy, and about preparedness or lack of it. There's nobody better to cover all this than Boulder resident Carolyn Baker. She's the author of Navigating the Coming Chaos and a new book coming out in November titled Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths About Turbulent Times. She's an expert in psychology and so many other things. Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, how bad were these floods in human terms as far as homes destroyed, lives lost, bridges out, those sorts of numbers? Can you give us some of the picture?
Yes, I'll try to do that. We had over 18 inches of rain falling in about 5 days, and 7 to 11 of those happen in a single 24-hour period. Our average rainfall here is 11 inches. We had at least 200 miles of Colorado that were hit from north to south. 17 counties were affected, 30 bridges destroyed. We had close to 20,000 homes damaged. We also had close to 20,000 people that were evacuated. Our toll of missing people is down now into the 100s, but we do have 8 people confirmed dead. So that's the human toll.
Right. And what is the situation now, just over a week later?
Well, there's been a lot of cleaning up in Boulder. I was out driving around this morning, and things look considerably different. Streets are open that weren't a week ago today. But throughout the state, it's another matter. We had 2 main arteries up to the city of Estes Park, Highway 36 and Highway 34, that were just taken out. There are huge chunks of those highways that it will take months to repair because they're gone. And the city of Estes Park, which is a huge tourist location right on the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. They have no water, no electricity, no phone service, and they're telling tourists, which is their bread and butter, to stay away.
How do you read the emotional and psychological reaction and what you hear from residents and from the local media?
Well, it's been a huge trauma, and I've really seen a lot of Boulder people pull together. I think it's a shock for some Boulder people who are, you know, this is a rather upscale community where, you know, people are very comfortable here. And for some of those folks, I think it's come as a real shock that this could happen to us because, you know, we talk a lot about the Boulder bubble, and some people now realize that bubble has burst.
Well, sometimes I've noticed, Carolyn, people get pumped up and a new community spirit rises right after an exciting challenge like a flood or a storm, but that can subside into the reality of closed stores, lost jobs, and a lot of crisis in families that never do get helped. I wonder if the real problems won't surface months after a disaster, one personal crisis at a time when the news has gone off to somewhere else. What do you think?
Oh, I think you're definitely right about that. Right now, people are just focused on cleaning up and rebuilding. And, you know, most people don't have flood insurance. Who has flood insurance in Colorado, right? And so most people are paying out of pocket. So they're going to be dealing with financial concerns and rebuilding and cleaning up for a long time. The overall larger picture of how this is affecting our infrastructure and how this is affecting our ecology is going to be much longer term. By the way, there are some people now who, you know, maybe they had 10 or 20 minutes commute to work. Now they're having, because of all these road closures, to drive 2 and 3 hours to get to work. And that's going to impact people psychologically big time.
Well, I know there are a lot of very nice houses in the Boulder area, but I also saw some news footage of trailer parks just totally buried, and a lot of those people are poor people or seniors. As you say, they probably don't have flood insurance. They're homeless now.
Right. Now, the only trailer parks that you've seen on the news, those were not in Boulder. Those were in Lyons and other places. The Boulder ones have not been submerged or affected very much by water damage. But, you know, upscale homeowners that have fire insurance and all kinds of other insurance, many of them don't have flood insurance because it's just, you know, it's very expensive to get it here, and nobody thinks about floods until now.
I still think there will be some new homeless people in Colorado after this, whether outside of Boulder or wherever.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question there will be. We've got a lot of homeless people now, just as, and they don't know where they're going to go. We still have our YWCA, which is where YMCA, where I go work out every day. Part of that has been turned into an evacuation shelter, and then we have many, many shelters throughout the region. So people are getting good care, and we've gotten a lot of help from FEMA. That got a lot of federal funds coming in, you know, but that's right now. I think the longer term picture is going to be more disturbing.
And all this news, of course, is about humans, our buildings, our roads. Nobody adds up the natural damage like stream banks destroyed, the failed trees that were so critical to preventing erosion and mudslides, and the whole ecosystem, dead animals. It's like the natural world doesn't exist in the news reporting. Is this just about us?
No, it absolutely is not about us. Even before this flood, we started to see here in Boulder and throughout Colorado, lots of bears coming down from the mountains because they're hungry. And they're hungry because of climate change. They're hungry because a lot of their food was burned up in these horrible fires that we had last year. You know, I do want to say that the Humane Societies of Denver and of Boulder have done an excellent job in rescuing pets. But this is going to affect the ecosystem and animals and all living things around us for a very long time.
Right. And, you know, their carbon emissions are pretty low.
The
animals.
Yes. No kidding.
They really are innocents in this. And we don't seem to care very much about that. And I think that's a shame. Well, now, regarding the impacts on our society and economy, I think Boulder will turn out to be more significant than just another disaster. I'm hearing comparisons to Katrina already. The governor of Colorado says we will rebuild. They always say that. But like New Orleans, some things will not be and cannot be rebuilt, like those stream banks we just talked about, like the places that are obviously set to flood again. Can it all go back to the way it was?
No, absolutely not. Now, a lot of homeowners will be able to come through this and rebuild, and they'll have the funds to make that happen. But when we get out of Boulder in the surrounding areas, such as a little town of Jamestown that was, you know, like a couple people dead, only a population of about 175, but they were a really sweet little community, and that place is pretty much gone forever. I don't know if Lyons is going to be able to rebuild. They were pretty much in a canyon between here and Estes Park. Most of the evacuations by helicopter took place from there. You know, in those surrounding communities that aren't as affluent as Boulder, there's not going to be as much rebuilding as they're talking about, for sure.
Well, you know what happened in Canada after the floods in Calgary? The government, the provincial government there said, yes, we'll help you rebuild, for some people at least, but we're only going to do it once. So if you rebuild where it has flooded and you know it can flood, the next time it happens, don't come to us. And I think that's a reasonable policy for the taxpayers.
Yeah, I do too.
Let's talk about all the energy involved, all that infrastructure, including those buildings and roads and bridges. They were built with oil at cost between $15 and $35 a barrel. Now, you and I have followed peak oil for a long time. Oil's over $100 a barrel now. That means everything will cost 3 to 6 times more just for the energy, and the same goes for the steel and the other components. They're way more expensive. Events like this may eventually break cities and states or even countries. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have no doubt that events like this are going to break cities and states. That is without question. And a huge concern that many of us have now are the fracking wells and oil wells around us, pretty much to the east of Boulder, that have become flooded. And there's toxic stuff floating around in the floodwaters that come from these wells. We have no idea what's in there. And some people are saying there's a news blackout on it. There's not much reporting on it, certainly not from official sources, certainly not from our governor, who last year went on camera and drank fracking fluid on camera to quote-unquote prove that it's safe. And, you know, we get a lot of stories about he's so climate change aware. He went to the Copenhagen seminar and, you know, he's really concerned about it. And that really is not so as you look at how he's actually behaving. So it's very scary that we have all this, you know, energy floating around in fracking fluid and oil and whatever, actually flowed into the South Platte River and is flowing across people's farms and fields. And it's very scary, and I don't know if that we'll get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, I recommend people look up the Facebook page of a group called East Boulder County United. They publish photos of fracking tanks full of God knows what, sitting in fields, tipped over, even floating down swollen rivers. It was never designed for floods. And, you know, I've seen photos in Colorado of fracking towers right beside suburbs, beside schoolyards, even kids' playgrounds. We all know fracking operations meant tons of noxious gases. How is that possible?
Well, it's possible because our esteemed governor is in bed with the energy companies. We do have a congresswoman, Diane DeGette, who's out in Weld County, where most of the fracking is taking place. And she has worked very hard to get that county fracking free. She's really on board with the activists. But, you know, the powers that be in terms of energy in the state are much bigger.
What is the name of that governor?
The name of the governor, John Hickenlooper.
John Hickenlooper. Well, we'll have to remember his name if he's drinking fracking fluid.
I do want to cite some things that were in this article this morning by a woman named Rebecca Anderson. This is a Huffington Post article in the green section entitled Colorado Floods and Climate Change, the Elephant in the Room. And she just points out that, you know, it's not a matter of if climate change was involved. It's just a matter of how much it was involved. There's no way that it wasn't involved in some form. With 40% more CO2 in the atmosphere than in pre-industrial times and 4% more water vapor in the atmosphere than 40 years ago, our world is fundamentally altered, and there's no control group to compare us to. We're all a living experiment, you might say. And I've been saying, well, I want to wait for the hard data because we're ground zero here in Boulder for three climate research facilities. But this woman raises the point that we might think of this in terms of comparing it with athletes who are on steroids. You know, if a guy gets caught, an athlete, a baseball player, for example, gets caught using steroids, we don't ask, well, was this particular home run the result of those steroids? We look at his overall statistics. And so in the same way, we look at climate change and these kinds of events, and we don't say, was the Boulder flood caused by climate change? Rather, look at the pattern, not only here in this state, but in all the floods, tornadoes, and wildfires that have been taking place in the last, specifically last 2 or 3 years on this continent.
Well, not just on this continent, around the world, as you know and have been reporting in your news service. I mean, whether it's Taiwan or eastern China, over into Siberia, and, of course, Australia a couple of years ago, Britain has been flooded out. I could go on and on. It's just happening around the world the way it's never happened before. You are listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Carolyn Baker, author of Navigating the Coming Chaos and host of the website Speaking Truth to Power. Well, another aspect of this, and another reason why I think it's so important, the Colorado floods showed the world the unpreparedness of the average citizen. I saw news footage of people desperately being airlifted away from completely undamaged homes after just 4 days. 4 days. It was early September in Colorado. They were in no danger of freezing to death. Didn't they have some food and water stored for emergencies?
Well, I think most people didn't. There was, I think it was on Wednesday of last week, which was the second, well, it was the first really big day of the floods. And there was a lot of going to the grocery store and kind of cleaning out the shelves and so forth. But by the end of the week, you know, people were in pretty bad shape as far as having food. And a lot of people just, you know, this really took them by surprise. We just don't get these kinds of floods in Colorado. Now, we got some flooding last month and the month before that in Colorado Springs when Fountain Creek came down from Manitou Springs and the area that was above the Waldo Canyon fire, the terrible fire that happened there last year. That area, Manitou Springs, was really, really hammered. So we looked at that. They're 80, 100 miles away from us, and we said, yeah, okay, so the flooding is over. We don't get this kind of rain in the fall anyway in Colorado. And so we were totally taken by surprise on lots of levels.
You write that Boulder is among the most advanced communities in transition, or at least a very progressive place. Let's talk about some of the positive things going on there.
Sure. One of the most positive things happening in Boulder that I'm directly associated with is the Local Food Shift. And you can go to their website, localfoodshift.com, formerly Transition Colorado, and they are working very hard to make Boulder food secure, self-sufficient, and they are also doing great things with getting people to invest in local food and using local food as a means of economic development. So that is one of the wonderful things, and I think one of the most important things going on here. Also, we have a really good anti-fracking movement in this town, and it's, you know, really throughout the state, but they have succeeded in getting a moratorium, at least for the next year, by the county commissioners on fracking in Boulder County. I don't know what's going to happen, you know, within the next year, if that will sustain or if it will be changed, but they've succeeded in doing that. We also have a group of activists who are working very hard, and we put it on the ballot last year to vote for a Boulder Power and Light Company so that we could turn this town, for the most part, into running off of solar energy and transitioning from coal and natural gas. And that's a very exciting development here.
That's a huge development, and it could help you very much, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line if it can happen.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely would.
So did something change with Transition Colorado or Transition Voice? What happened there?
The focus of the people who were doing the Transition Colorado, they wanted to really, really focus on the food issue and to use other resources to do that and not limit it to the agenda of transition. And there's a very strong transition movement in Denver. The people, Michael Brownlee and Lynette Marie Hanthorne, who actually started transition in the United States, they developed the first transition group here in Boulder, and they decided to just move on from being limited to transition activities exclusively to focusing on local food.
Now, you wrote a really great article called All Dress Rehearsals Are Over. You can find that at your website, carolynbaker.net. And in it, you bring out this idea I want to just develop a little bit. People have the idea they'll find a retreat property and they'll be okay on their own. And some people will be, and I don't say that's a bad idea, but the scale of this Colorado flooding also tells me we might need national and international action to get a survivable climate. That's a given. These giant weather events are almost too big for homesteads or individuals to tackle. Am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think you are wrong. I think you're absolutely right on the money. I do have some friends who have a homestead now up in the hills above Salida, Colorado, and they have created an amazing place up there, just phenomenal. And they have some neighbors around them within a mile around them, but no one who's really interested in preparing for the future. And they're finding themselves a bit lonely in that environment. Certainly if there were a huge emergency around them, I'm sure that the neighbors would all pull together. But this has been their major concern since moving up there and creating what they've created, is that they're a bit lonely because they don't have allies in their endeavors. And I just think that, you know, I'm watching some positive things here in Boulder with people pulling together and neighbors helping neighbors. And it was wonderful when everything just kind of slowed down for a few days and people were helping each other with getting water out of their basements or their houses or just gathering in public places and talking about it if they weren't affected. You cannot do the collapse of industrial civilization on your own. It just isn't going to happen. You're not going to last very long if you attempt to do that.
You know, when we lived off the grid without electricity back in the early 80s, the power could have gone out for 3 or 4 days, and I would go into town and go, oh, it did? I mean, I just had no idea.
Right.
So it is possible for people to be fairly independent and certainly last more than the 4 days that we saw the people praying for the helicopters. If you have a big regional disaster, which is possible for a lot of different reasons, we won't go into all the different reasons, but it's possible, there won't be enough helicopters to come and get everybody. So what could people do on their own to it, just as a basic level of preparedness? What would you suggest?
Well, I would suggest getting Matt Steen's book, When Technology Fails. And I would say that is a major manual for all kinds of basic preparation. When Technology Fails, Matt Steen, you can get it on Amazon, and he has a website, mattsteen.com, spelled S-T-E-I-N. So there's that, and then there's just the basics of, you know, just having a few days or a week or 2 weeks of food stored, and storing water, which is very, very important. You know, we've got big water issues here with some of it not being drinkable, lots of contamination. You know, there's the fill the bathtub thing and keep some water in there for washing for your pets, perhaps. And, you know, if you have any first aid supplies, to store some of those and have those handy. Certainly lights and candles and all of the things that have to do with power. You know, have your blankets for if it's really cold. Those sorts of things. Just basic preparations for being able to get by a couple of weeks, you know, and many people don't even have those. They just make 4 or 5 trips a week to the grocery store, like that's going to last forever.
Well, this shows where I am on the paranoia scale, because I do have at least 6 months and possibly a year's worth of food stored in the basement with big buckets of grain. A grain mill, some rice, and all the, even the spices you might want to make it more edible. We have a stream near us where you can go down there with buckets. We've got water purification tablets. We've got the works, because there are possibilities of a major disaster happening, whether it's a solar storm or whatever. And I think that we should be prepared to some degree if we can afford it. I know there's some people can't get enough food on the shelves for 2 weeks, so we all do what we can. But I think we should be ready for these things. It's like buying home insurance. I hope I'll never use my home insurance, but I pay that premium every year.
Right, absolutely.
And it cost me less than $500, incidentally, to get that food supply organized, so I think it's worth a shot.
You know, I'll just mention this. I have been told by some people in the know that there have been contingency plans in case Washington, D.C. became inoperable as the capital of our government. There have been contingency plans for Denver to be the other government. I don't know if that's true, but I know that we have a lot of military installations in this state, particularly in the Colorado Springs area, and I suspect that those military installations would be engaged immediately if we had a major, major disaster. Not that that's necessarily a good thing, but I think that would be the agenda if we had a major regional disaster.
Right. Well, another aspect of this, as you mentioned, the climate change part, in your article, all dress rehearsals are over. You remind us that Boulder has 3 significant climate research centers as well. Have they said anything so far about this? I guess they wouldn't. I mean, scientists take a long time to study things.
Well, scientists take a long time, and I'm wondering what the condition of the homes of those scientists are at the moment. You know, are they cleaning up their homes? Have they even had a chance to go into work this week? I don't know. I have a friend who's coming from California to visit me next week, and I'm planning to take her up to the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And while we're there, I think we'll just go in and start asking some questions. We have the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, which is connected with the University of Colorado. We have NOAA here, National Oceanic Research. So we have 3 big climate change research facilities here in Boulder, and I personally am chafing at the bit to find out how they connect the dots.
If you have the chance, and if they'll let you, maybe take a tape recorder.
Well, yes, and certainly I could do some reporting on that in you know, in my daily news digest.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is author, news hound, preparedness and psychology expert, and a part-time radio host, Carolyn Baker. She lives in Boulder, Colorado, and was there for the record-breaking flash floods in September 2013. Carolyn, this case of sudden floods in Colorado also reminds us there can be knock-on effects from climate-driven mega-weather a year or even years later. In New Jersey, officials are now saying the huge fire that burned down that just-rebuilt boardwalk was likely caused by electrical systems damaged by Hurricane Sandy in 2012. And you have a similar delayed impact that you mentioned in Colorado. How did last year's giant fires affect possibly these recent floods?
Well, we have, there's been news footage on all of the major networks of land above Lyons, for example, up in the hills and above Fort Collins, where they had terrible fires last year. And, you know, the barren trees, the dead trees that are standing there that have been burned and charred, and there's no vegetation on the ground. And so this water could just come rushing down the mountain through the canyons into cities and on people's land. There's nothing to hold it back. And that is because of the terrible wildfires that we've had in the last couple of years. So it all works together. And I don't know what our delayed reactions here are going to be. I suspect we're going to have more wildfires next year. And this so-called 100-year flood or 500-year flood, you know, hey, that could happen next month. I don't know.
Exactly. We all don't know. It's one big experiment, as you said. And that widespread damage and the nearly impossible cost of rebuilding that we talked about earlier points us to a pathway of economic collapse. And in this scenario, we just keep getting hit with climate-driven disasters and other problems until we're far too broke and broken to rebuild. The roads don't get rebuilt. The bridges stay out. Some communities may be abandoned. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. And, you know, this is what I talk about all the time in the reporting that I do with the Daily News Digest and articles that I write and other people's articles that I have. And, you know, when I'm on Mike Rupert's show and we talk about, you know, we're looking at a collapsing culture, a collapsing society. This is the end of industrial civilization and its paradigm. And so it's very possible that we can have days like we had yesterday or the day before on Wall Street where, you know, they have record-breaking profits coming in. And, you know, and that's all going on in New York. And the rest of the country can be homeless and in tatters. That's entirely possible because that's where we're headed, you know, where we have the 1% controlling everything and the other 99% are in shambles.
Well, as you know, Carolyn, among those who believe collapse is inevitable, there's been an ongoing debate about how it arrives. One camp thinks we could see a rapid fall of the system any time now, and others see a bumpy downward slide over a decade or two. Who are some of the people in each position?
Well, Mike Rupert tends to believe that things are going to happen pretty quickly and that it's all very imminent. John Michael Greer is kind of on the other end of the spectrum. He thinks that things are going to go very slowly. He did write a book called The Long Descent. I'm very much, I think, in the middle of all of that. I see things as, yes, a roll down a bumpy hill, and then there are tipping points like the flood we just had last week, like these terrible fires and hurricanes and other natural disasters, the economic collapse of 2008, that push us over the edge of the cliff a little bit more. So it's a both and as far as I am concerned.
Right. I think about the $60 billion cost allegedly of Hurricane Sandy. That happened to states that are already really bankrupt. They just don't admit it. They keep taking from their pension plans or whatever they have to do to keep it all going. We've got a federal government that's, what, $15 trillion or more in debt, and they've just announced they're going to keep on printing $85 billion a month in phony money. So these costs as they come, the rising seas that come up and take away parts of the coastside and the ports, there's no way that this can just keep on going. Sooner or later, whether it's a bump or a crash, things are going to fall away.
That's absolutely true. There's no question. And we are heading for a society in which most of us, the 99%, you know, are if not penniless, at least living very minimally because we don't have very much. Well, like I said, Wall Street can continue playing their game and doing their charade that they do, but as far as what we really have in the United States, it's going to be wiped out by these climate change events.
And for seniors in Poland, they just grabbed all the private pension money and took it for the government so they could continue to bolster their credit rating and borrow even more money. The same thing happened in Argentina. I expect to see that happen around the world. Wherever there's a little pool of money that people have saved up, they'll bail in, as they did in Cyprus, and take it away. And that's another reason we need food self-reliance, even for seniors, and more local communities, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I expect to see Cyprus-type events here. I think Detroit is a warm-up for that in terms of what they're doing with the pensions. You know, and that'll be a longer, slower kind of thing, but I think we're going to see Cyprus events where things are just grabbed overnight. So you better have some food to rely on, and you better have some networking going on with your neighbors and friends, and be making a community so that when this kind of stuff happens, you're not on your own and you can help sustain each other.
I'm Alex Smith with Carolyn Baker. Everybody should read Carolyn's article, All Dress Rehearsals Are Over, published from Boulder on September 16, 2013. It's powerful, and it inspired many of the things we're talking about today. You can find it at carolynbaker.net, and I'll put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.info. And I also want to recommend this article, Paradigm Shifts and Tipping Points, Part 2 by Gary Stamper and Michael Wolff. It was published in Carolyn's blog on September 18th. And in Gary Stamper's blog, CollapsingIntoConsciousness.com. Carolyn, what is Gary contributing to this debate about how long we keep living these unsustainable lives?
Well, I think he's doing a lot of work similar to mine. He's putting a tremendous effort into his website, and he's been doing work with men for a long time and the integral consciousness, kind of in the vein of Ken Wilber. I think one of Gary's major contributions is he's helping us really look at the patriarchal system, the system that is based on power and control and male domination of things. And he's really helping us integrate the two energies, the masculine and the feminine, in order to create a new culture.
Well, men are still more or less controlling the world, and in certain parts of the world, they definitely control the world. So a change in men's consciousness is going to be important, and I feel just from my talking to men around me that it's possible the males will have more trouble adapting to the coming challenges than women will. What do you think?
Well, I definitely think that is so. One of the problems with men is the intellect, and of course we need the intellect, we need thinking, we need reason. But men have been so cut off by the culture, from their feelings, from their hearts. I think that that's the major number that collapse is going to do on men, is it's going to drag them kicking and screaming into the emotions. And I really want to salute Gary for his work that he's done around that.
And despite what you read in some blogs, we're not going to shoot our way out of these problems.
We
need networking.
Not.
We need cooperation. We need those things that, frankly, women have been better at developing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Also want to mention, since you're mentioning my work, I'm going to be in your neighborhood, Bowen Island, British Columbia, November 8th and 9th, doing a public talk and a workshop there. I'll be having details about that soon on my website and on my Facebook page and on Twitter, so just to let you know.
You've also got a book coming out in November. Tell us about that.
Yes. I had always wanted to write a book of reflections. You know, I've written these other two books on collapse, sacred demise, and navigating the coming chaos. So I was very inspired to write a book in which a person could pick it up and just read one page a day to inspire them as they go through this journey of this unraveling and this uncertain future. So I submitted 19 essays to the publisher with 365 reflections, and they said, well, this is a very long book. It may present problems with pricing and translation. So why don't we cut it down to 17 essays, and then we'll create 52 weekly reflections in the hard copy book, and we'll put the rest of the reflections in an ebook. So that's what's coming out November 19th. It's called Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. You can read more about it on my website.
You have a news service where you gather up some of the worst news in the world, the stuff the mainstream media just leaves out, and you also have positive solutions. But I know how much work that is. You're talking about coming books and past books. You're talking about public appearances and speeches. I know you do personal counseling. How do you survive knowing about the bad things that are happening? How do you do it personally?
Well, that's what all of my writing is about. It's about bringing together the dark, dark, dark side of our reality that we're facing, and then learning from that, using that as an opportunity to teach us about things like community, to teach us about compassion, to teach us about why we're really here. What is our purpose? What gifts did we bring here that we have to give to the rest of the world? And to stop getting, you know, stop the mindset of business as usual and, oh, I'm just living my life, to looking at the larger picture of what is going on and why did we come here at this time and what do we have to offer? What is our purpose? That's really what most of my work is about. It's not about making us feel good. I don't offer solutions because there aren't any solutions, but I do offer a lot of options and a lot of different ways that we can live our lives to make this not easy, but easier for ourselves and everyone else.
For me, I think it's partly a combination of curiosity about the future. This is a huge drama, one never before seen in history. I've read a lot of history. There's nothing like this, especially when we're talking about climate change and the energy picture as well. But it's also a deep emotion and feeling of love for my children and my grandchildren. I want them to do as well as they can, and I would like to kind of make up for the damage that my generation has done. So that's what motivates me. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking over lessons from the amazing Colorado floods with Boulder resident and longtime preparedness coach Carolyn Baker. You can get advice directly from Carolyn and get ready with her books at carolynbaker.net. Carolyn, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
My little hen, she's a rare breed. She only eats organic feed. No GMOs, no Frankenstein. Monsanto ain't no saint of mine. Cluck old hen, cluck and sing.
The last time we talked with Dan Imhoff, it was about the big dark images in the book CAFO, The Tragedy of Industrial Animal Factories. Now the co-founder, director, and publisher of Watershed Media is back with a more positive vision of where we could go, but it's not a book. His new album of songs is called Agraria. Dan, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, after 20 years of writing about food and the environment, where did this whole other talent come from?
You know, I've been playing music all my life. There was a time as a teenager I was really keen on music all through college. And then I kind of gave it up for a few reasons as I really focused on learning how to write and raise a family. And around 1995, I started to play the guitar again in earnest. And because I spend so much time during the day working on things of a technical nature, try to popularizing kind of technical, scientific, policy, etc. for the general audiences, writing songs became a real release for me. For some reason, I would often just, you know, as I was playing, come up with songs because writing is what I do. And this kind of evolved very naturally as I got older and I got back into something that I was really, really interested in as a young person.
And are you living in California, Dan?
Yeah, I live in Northern California. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good spot for a lot of good music, too. Well, let's get to the title. What is Agraria?
You know, Agraria, to me, it's that ideal. It's this place that we're trying to become, where we are living in harmony on the land, and where all those great things that make humans great really are emphasized and come out. And for me, kind of food production, healthy food production, living in concert with the natural world, making music, eating well, all those things just are really the same thing to me. It's like the weeks roll into the months and the seasons, and you're just left with this process of tuning in and participating and trying to find out what's the best in you that you can share. And Agraria is this kind of, you know, ideal world that Jefferson hoped our country would have been built around, but it didn't go that way.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a little bit of the 1800s in that vision, but now we have to tune it for the fact that we may be using iPods as well, or some sort of modern technology.
Yeah, we're toolsy. We're toolsy animals. And our tools really define us, and they certainly have in agriculture and in the way we treat the land. I do try to write about that a fair amount. You know, I can't even get away from that even in songwriting. So I'm trying to just address this human condition that we have.
Well, one of my favorite tunes on the album is a traditional one, but you added some lyrics, I think. I don't remember anything about GMOs in Cluck Old Hen. What did you do there?
Yeah, there are some GMOs in Cluck Old Hen. Cluck Old Hen, you know, I was learning to play the mandolin, and one of the exercises was this great old, you can either go minor or major. I went minor, so it's a fiddle tune kind of ballad. And typically in the traditional version, it's really about this old chicken that hasn't laid an egg in a long time. And, you know, I think that there's some sexual connotations in the old traditional versions of that song. And my producer, Matt Wright, who works here in Sonoma County, a great young producer, said to me, well, you have to write your own lyrics to this song. So being a person who writes a lot about agriculture and animal agriculture, I really wrote it about chickens and even, you know, the difference between a free-range and organic chicken and then the industrial chicken and then the millions and billions of chickens that we raise every year that we just grind up to eat.
Yeah, I think there's more chickens on the planet than there are humans by far. How would you describe a couple of the other songs? Would you introduce our listeners to maybe one or two other songs that are on this album?
Sure. You know, the first song, Compass, it's really kind of a ballad or a waltz, a country waltz, and it's about two young people. One is this pretty girl at a farmer's market, and she is attracted to this guy who's a cowboy, and they try to make this life together on the land, and it goes well for a while. And you know how hard it is. You know, probably farming takes more creative talent to not only do the production, but the marketing and make things go in this world. And so Compass is a song that the chorus is really about, you know, just whoever's out there who can give these young people some luck and some guidance and let them know that they're on the right track. And they just have to stay with it. Give them this compass to keep them going in this worthy direction of trying to make a home on the land. That's Compass. And the beautiful thing really about making this record was working with so many incredible musicians. There's so many good musicians down here in Sonoma County, and every single musician on the record came from this county. They were pretty local. And then there's another song called Tumbleweed. Tumbleweed is almost a bluegrass breakdown. It's very, very fast-paced, has banjo and fiddle. And it's really about the passage of time, you know, how fast things are going, and then you turn around and you look back at the way that you thought things were going to go, and you just find that you're blowing along on the winds of time like a ragged tumbleweed is the chorus on that tune. So, you know, the Agraria has a lot of things in it. It has country blues. It has ballads, and then it has some really, really high-paced dancing bluegrass tunes.
But you know, it amazed me, I guess it shouldn't have amazed me, but it did, that this is no toss-off with a few kitchen friends, even though they may be your friends. The music's top, top quality, in my opinion, and the mixing and the production, this is a real, real album. So you're bringing out the idea of local music. I'm wondering, you know, as plants and ecosystems all grow up together, they form kind of a unique identity. Is that what's happening when you get musicians that are all from the same county to make an album like this?
Yeah, you know, the chemistry is important, obviously. The preparation is what's really important, I think, when you're making a record. I'm not a pro myself, so I might play music, you know, 4 hours a day, 6 hours a day on a good day, you know, but that's not enough to be a top-rate musician. And so I worked really closely with the producer, and we did a lot of back and forth in arranging the songs and trying to figure out the parts and get the right people for the parts. And then when you're in the studio, you know, things are going really fast and it's not cheap. And so you want to know what you're going to get when you're in there. And you just want to be able to have fun and see if there's some great happy accident or just, you know, what comes of this chemistry that you're making in the studio. It's really, truly not different than farming or food production or communication, anything that I do. I mean, there's a lot of, the more hard work that you do on the fundamentals, the better it pays off.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dan Imhoff. That's I-M-H-O-F-F. He's the author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to the Next Food and Farm Bill. Good for Americans to tune in to what's happening, or people all over the world to see what a farm bill should and should not be. He's also written Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World, and Farming with the Wild, Enhancing Biodiversity on Farms and Ranches. Do you have another book in the works as you do all this, Dan?
I don't have another book in the work right now, in the works. I'm really doing small projects that I hope are going to turn into something much bigger. You know, I definitely am still ambitious. I want to keep pushing this idea of conservation-based agriculture, of farming that it farms with nature rather than against nature. It uses the natural cycles of the surrounding ecosystem sustainably, meaning it's not drawing too much of the groundwater. It's giving plenty of space for the fluidity of creatures and natural cycles to take place on that piece of land. And I do believe that that's the real future of sustainable ag. So I want to write about that. But, you know, I want to write fiction, and I want to continue the songwriting. So I'm trying to just let things go. I am working still a lot on this issue of confined animal feeding operation agriculture, so big industrial animal operations, and that's really taking the place of these campaigns. We're about to launch a campaign to ask Walmart to get antibiotics out of the meat that it sells, and if we can do that, it would be a real, real turning point for the way animals are produced in this country and in the world. And I'm just working on educating people on this issue of industrial animal ag, because in my opinion, it is the real big, difficult issue that we're dealing with in agriculture.
Well, and it's a tough one to talk about. You know, I've raised chickens and I've raised pigs, and I'm afraid to talk about it almost, because it's so horrible what's happening to these animals, and they're smart and they're living and they deserve a life. So I think that's one of the barriers that you have to overcome, that people don't want to talk about it. They want to keep eating, but they don't want to know.
Yeah, they do. And we have to get better. I mean, look, we're on this continuum, we humans, with the animal world. And whenever I'm talking about this issue, I always start with the cave paintings of Lascaux and these absolutely gorgeous works of art that the early peoples, hominids, made, and this creaturely world that was just burning in their imaginations and allowed them to create these stunning works of art that we still recognize as some of the most beautiful things ever painted. and how we've come from that point, from that place where the creatures were all around us, to this place where the creatures are put inside these barns and they're completely almost invisible on the landscape, except if you happen to live in these rural areas, and the feed is trucked to them and the waste becomes this huge problem. There's this huge amount of healing that we have to get to. I'm finding actually that I'm more and more successful now if I just let industry talk for itself. So if you can match industry's words with the real pictures of what's happening, people get pretty angry and you know, people, they want to do the right thing. It costs money. It takes a lot of research and effort, and it's this huge issue. It is why farm policy is important and why I keep bashing my head against that, because it's going to take a huge initiative to make the changes that are necessary. It's going to cost money, and, you know, the government has to step up and do its job and regulate properly. And we have to keep the pressure on, though, if that's what we want to happen.
Well, the other thing that will help is to have a more positive vision, and that's what Agraria is all about, I think. So can you tell us about some of the cool things that are happening in Sonoma County, California?
Well, it's hot down here. Boy, it's been a hot summer, and I think there's a lot of grape growers down here that are pretty happy. It's been a very, very good growing season. It's been a really good, decent season in the garden. I'm a small-scale farmer. But it's dry, and we desperately need rain. You know, Sonoma's a place where we've got mountains, we've got rivers, we've got oceans, we've got a really good climate. For me, I live in this land that I call deep craft, where, you know, there's a lot of fisher people and hunters, there's a lot of incredible garden farmers, and then there's musicians, and there's people trying to raise families and kids kind of as a community. And so those things all knit together, and it is a kind of a little agrarian paradise down here.
Okay, I'll move in. I'll be coming. not really. I think.
No, it's probably great up there, let me tell you.
Everybody has to find their own place. I think that's how it works.
They do, absolutely.
So how do people get this album, Agraria? Is it the usual outlets, or do you have other ways of getting it?
Yeah, you can go to CD Baby. You can go to Amazon. Definitely you can get the hard CD or download it. You could ask your local record store to buy it. They'll probably still go to CD Baby to get the disc. And look online. There's a couple of YouTubes. You can hear some of it in advance to check it out. DanImhoff.com is another place to learn about the album and read the lyrics and the liner notes and things like that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You can find out more about Dan Imhoff, I-M-H-O-F-F, at watershedmedia.org or DanImhoff.com. And download links for this interview from my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks a lot for the time. It was great talking to you.
From the album Agraria, this is Compass.
She was a farmer's daughter. Worked the Saturday markets, casting charms on everyone. He was a well-dressed cowboy with a weakness for the bottle. Cupid plucked an arrow, pulled her bow back, and she shot him. Dirt under fingernails, feet on the ground. Far from those big city lights, Venus, Jupiter, anyone who's listening, please give these young people the compass they need. They were married in the fall under the old by the springtime blossoms, they were almost just a family. skin.